You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
For those of you who don't know me, my name is Adam Radwan, and I'm with the Open Society Fellowship Program. And very excited to introduce one of our own fellows today, Ben Rollins, who was selected for the fellowship last year and will be completing this year, actually. Ben's fellowship project has been, he's been conducting ethnographic research on Somali youth and Kenyan refugees, documenting their lives, interviewing them, and following them and seeing what struggles are happening. And for today's discussion, Ben will be talking about the opportunities and challenges to higher education in refugees. Moderating the discussion will be Martha Lorke, who is the director of the scholarships program here at OSF. So over to you, Ben.
All right. Well, thanks very much for having me. And I'm very grateful to OSF for funding the work that I've been doing. I'd like to tell you just a little bit about what that is. And then I've got kind of three questions for the foundations, really, which have sprung out of conversations I've had with other colleagues in Nairobi and London, and based on my insights from the CAM. Suggestions for places that the foundations could engage or things to think about. So as Adam said, for the last 18 months, I've been spending a lot of time in Dadaab, which is the largest refugee camp in the world. Current population is about 350,000 people, which is a little bit smaller than Atlanta, about the size of Zurich. It's nominally temporary because it's a refugee camp. There's no permanent structures, there's no plumbing, there's no roads, and yet it's been there for 25 years since the outbreak of war, the civil war in Somalia in 1991. So I've been spending time with people who live there, some of whom were born there, who've never left because the refugees can't leave, trying to see what life looks like from that very limited perspective, to try and then make some suggestions about how things could be done differently, and also more broadly to the Kenyan government, European governments, and the US government about what that experience suggests about their foreign policy approach to the region, both how they deal with refugees, but also counter-terror narratives in the Horn of Africa more widely. Because at present, the refugees are very much demonized. Kenya blames them for a lot of the insecurity that is happening in their country, when in fact they could be a real force for good, real allies in terms of Kenya's policy in Somalia, rather than being scapegoats. So spending that time hanging out with these young people and writing about them, which will be, those stories will be in a book that's going to come out at the beginning of 2016, which I'm just putting the finishing touches to. A number of questions arose. The main concern of those people, some of them, about 10 young people I've been following, some of them have not been to school at all, some of them have been to primary school, some of them have had some exposure to secondary education, and one or two have managed to get diplomas through distance learning in the camp that they have purchased from Nairobi, from the private universities in Nairobi. And there are challenges, there are educational challenges at all those three levels. So although this talk was, I think, headlined higher education, actually my point is about education generally and why that's important. The enrollment rates in primary education are around 42%. The enrollment rates in secondary education are around 13%. So very few of the refugees in the camp are finding places at school. And that's because there are not enough places, there are not enough teachers, it's a capacity problem. And it's also because although education is supposed to be free, there are actually very real financial barriers, because you have to have a uniform, you have to have a notebook, things which cost money, and the economy of the camp is primarily a non-cash barter economy, because people get their food aid rations from the World Food Programme and then they exchange those for other things. So cash is often hard to come by, and it might take weeks or even months of saving up, selling part of your food rations to afford something like a school uniform. So the access to education is very, very limited. It's actually more or less the same as numbers in Somalia, which is at war. So primary education enrollment and secondary education enrollment are similar. And you have, therefore, similar effects, that the youth who are not involved in education are at risk of either being pulled into armed groups or at risk of being exploited. There's a lot of child labour. And, of course, in a more general way, being very unaware of their rights and of their own self-realisation. This is important because from the experience of talking to the kids, even the tiniest brush with primary education is enough to open up a window of ambition in their minds that their life could be something or could mean something other than simply just survival and getting by. The other window that is opening up is a window of self-realization, so that you can question some of the received assumptions of the clan and of the conservative society that exists in the Horn of Africa. And for those people who have progressed through that, who've gone through secondary education, and some of those who've got the distance learning diplomas, there is a real generational struggle. So you have this very unique generation grown up in the camp, many of whom were born after 91, 92, who've never left, but who have been raised in this kind of liberal bubble, sponsored by the UN, with a UN calendar, such as Global Handwashing Day, Global Violence Against Women Day, that they celebrate and that they take very seriously. In a society that is dominated by the UN, so there's a hierarchy of aid agencies. And as with any society, our ambition generally goes to the top of the hierarchy, and the top of the hierarchy is the UNHCR. So most of these young people want to work for the NGOs like CARE and Oxfam and Save the Children and the UN. That is their dream. And they have a much more liberal outlook. And they've coined phrases like 2040, and they call themselves the generation who are aged between 20 and 40, i.e., anybody who's over 40 was an adult at the outbreak of the Civil War and is therefore somehow complicit in the problems and is to blame for the war. Whereas those people who are under 40, who were children at the time, and those who are over 20, who are now conscious adults who have some responsibility, these are the people whom the youth refer to among themselves as having responsibility now for taking the country forward, for bringing peace. And there's a very sharp divide between those people who've come of age in the camp and the elders who have not. And there's very, very sharp differences in cultural outlook as well, in terms of choosing your own husband or your own wife, in terms of your attitude to FGM and female cutting, as well as the role of women as breadwinners, as teachers, as people with careers. So this generation represents, I think, a real opportunity for anybody who's interested in helping them in what they want to achieve with their home country, both for Kenya as a sort of rebuke to its counter-terror policy, for the West that's interested in sponsoring a middle class in Somalia, and for private foundations like this one that want to support people who can be catalysts for those things. So one of the things I'm trying to argue for is to see that population full of possibility rather than as a bunch of refugees who are trapped and who are simply kicking their heels and waiting to work for Al-Shabaab. The other point that I wanted to make about helping is that so far, OSEA and a lot of other donors, including Western governments in Kenya, their main approach to countering the abuse of rights that comes along with the whole nexus of counter-terror policy that we're all very familiar with now, is to support NGO rights-based NGOs who make noise, who advocate on behalf of refugees or on behalf of other people who are caught up in the sweep. For example, there was this thing called Usalama Watch in Kenya, where the Kenyan government wanted to round up anybody who looked Somali in Nairobi and Mombasa and ship them all off to Dadaab or deport them back to Mogadishu. And it was basically a carte blanche for extortion, rape, a wider range of human rights abuses. That's a very sort of common occurrence in Nairobi. And the general approach on all of these issues has to fund these very effective NGOs like Kitu Chashiria, like Halameen Kimathi, people who are OSEA, grantees of OSEA, who I've been working with at Human Rights Watch for many years. And that's important, and it's good, and it keeps the issues on the agenda, and it does create a certain space. However, the ability of NGOs to actually protect any of these people or to really change their circumstances is very limited. And it struck me that what about instead of or in addition to the advocacy work, what about enabling these people to better protect themselves, to better defend their own rights and to work within their own communities, to do a lot of this work, whether it's simply documentation and protest or whether it's actually to create more abiding social structures to safeguard the rights of their people. You know, I'm talking about a social progressive advance more generally. And you know, the main complaint from the reason I'm coming out with that criticism is that the main complaint from the young refugees in the camp is not, you know, my rights are being abused and I feel that the Kenyan government is marginalising me. It's I want to go to school. And that starts with primary school as well as secondary school as well as further education. So I think there's a big opportunity there where the Kenyan government is failing to provide universal education, not just for the refugees but also for the Kenyan populations in northern Kenya. And instead of this quite antagonistic relationship that Open Society has and Western donors have with the Kenyan government, which I know has been an issue for OSEA, there's actually an opportunity here for them to be on the same side and to promote the same things. And I think the Kenyan government might really like it, actually, if at a very high level it had a conversation with Open Society and said, you know what, instead of publishing these diagrams of conspiracy theories in the Kenyan newspapers about how we are how you think we're trying to advocate for a regime change, actually we'd like to work with you to instead of being hostile on your abuse of rights, we want to say actually maybe we can work with you to promote the rights of these groups of people, not necessarily the civil and political rights that we've been fighting about in the past, but maybe some of the social, economic and cultural rights like education, which actually in the long run would be in your interests, and to develop actually there a platform of commonality with the Kenyan government. There are all sorts of wrinkles in terms of the politics of how that might be implemented, because it would need to be not just the refugees but also other marginalised populations. But that for me, looking at the region as a whole, are the twin threats to the existence of open societies in the region, both in Somalia and in Kenya and in Ethiopia. In Somalia, it's more the existence of these extremist ideologies and the success of the madrasa model, because the madrasas are free, you don't have a uniform, you write on a slate. They're very small, they're on every block, they're very accessible, and they're heavily funded by Saudi, UAE, Qatar, and so on. So that investment on the side of of the Conservatives has not been matched on the side of the progressives or the liberal agenda. The UNICEF fund on education in Somalia is 80% unfunded every year, year on year on year. And that's only maintaining this very, very minimum level that I've talked about of 12% in secondary education and 42% in primary education. So Kenya here has, and all of the countries in the region have a job to do to redress that balance. So in Somalia, it's very much the investment on the side of the Conservatives that's the threat to open societies. In Ethiopia and Kenya, it's that, but coupled with the very heavy-handed reaction then from the state against these marginalized populations who are struggling with the very same dilemma. And of course, as we all know, the heavy-handed approach to those marginalized populations ends up actually making it worse by treating all the whole community with the same brush. And in the approach to the refugee camp, by squeezing all the opportunities in the camp, by not letting people leave, by cutting the rations, by forcing people back to Somalia, actually alienating more and more people whom you should be looking to as allies in your goals. So what that means for open society in my, you know, very humble and limited opinion, because I don't know very much about how the foundations work, is to question the focus on NGOs. I think the focus on NGOs is good, but I wondered if there could be if that could be broadened to maybe formal educational structures. It does seem to me there's a wariness in the foundation with getting involved with primary education, secondary education, but in the Horn of Africa, in the terms of the open society debate, that's the front line. It's very much the front line. In Somalia, in the Muslim areas, Somali areas of southern Ethiopia, and the Somali areas and the Muslim areas of the coast, which are at risk of radicalization, Mombasa and so on, it's very much the primary schools who are on the front line versus the madrasas. That's where... I'm not necessarily talking about, in very crude terms, about the risks of children going into armed groups, because those numbers are actually pretty small. I'm just talking about conservative forces in society, which in fact is what's probably more urgent there is the position of women and girls in Kenyan society or in Somali society. Human rights more on a more macro level, not necessarily just the instrumentalization of stopping kids going to join Al-Shabaab, but the tenor of an open democratic society rather than one which is ruled by mullahs who, you know, take their orders from some rather murky place. So that's the first question, is whether or not there is a role in supporting somehow the primary and secondary education, both in those countries, but also specifically with the refugees. The second question is that Somalia is at a crossroads. The nature of the conflict there has changed. It's no longer a geographical one with front lines and areas of control. More or less now, AMISOM and the Somali federal government are assuming control of the main cities, and Al-Shabaab is in these pockets. But what it's turned instead into a more guerrilla-style conflict, where Shabaab is popping up and targeting particular people, particular convoys and installations, which means that a lot of people are coming back, the diaspora is returning, that there is investment in new universities, in new infrastructure in Mogadishu. There's an opportunity here to be a part of adding to the balance of liberal forces in Somalia versus the very heavy weights that are on the conservative side of the scales. And there's a major need, because most of the money that goes to Somalia at the moment is in the security sector. There's an awful lot of corruption. And I think in order for... The best way, in fact, for people to engage with the Somali state or the Somali society in general is probably the private line, in the way that the Turks are establishing a university, in the way that some of the diaspora have got together to build another university called Atlas in Mogadishu. I was saying to Martha earlier, obviously I'd like to see a Soros university in Mogadishu, but given that that's probably not going to happen, wondering whether it might be possible to think about ways of supporting these secular liberal institutions, which are going to be playing a crucial role in creating new leaders and a middle class in Somalia, and maybe links with the refugees as well, that whether that might be possible. And the second thing was, stemming from that, was supporting secular secondary education, whether in the camp there might be a role for a Soros secondary school or supporting some of the secondary schools. The Aga Khan, the Ismaili community in East Africa, has supported hospitals, universities, secondary schools. The Aga Khan school in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam and Kampala, they are usually the best ones. And that plays a very major role in creating a liberal Muslim space in those societies, which I think are incredibly important when you have these governments that are so prejudiced and that are, in fact, using those fault lines to manipulate even further civil strife, to obfuscate their own agenda, as we've seen with definitely in Kenya, and increasingly in other countries are learning those games of stigmatizing and then raising the counter-terror flag and then actually using that to get a lot of Western influence and Western space then to crack down on other human rights. It seems to be the sharp end in what's happening, certainly in Kenya, is that you talk about the counter-terror thing, you double down on the Somalis, and then all of a sudden you're talking about shoot to kill more widely, you're talking about suspending certain provisions of the constitution. It's the beginning of another conversation. So for many reasons, I think this area is key, and thinking more creatively about how to get the government on side or get into a position where you're able to talk to the government and share goals rather than this very, very oppositional thing, which is basically only going to end up in everybody getting deported. The need to find some other kind of common ground, and then also to think about how to enable how to enable these communities to support the positive elements within them, rather than simply just shouting every time they get jailed. So those are my suggestions. I hope they're some, you know, at least. You've heard them.
No problem. We'll go do it, right?
Whether or not you think they're good ideas. But if you want to ask some questions, then I think I'll stop there and we can do that.
My question, I think I would like to start, because for me it's a very new geography, and I'm aware that there's probably a lot of different layers that go on. And I'm curious about why the origins of the Kenyan discrimination against the Somalis in the first place. And that leads me to question, in the camps, are there, you said there was a little bit of a clan-based society, and what is that based on? Is that economic class-based, or is it simply different ethnicities? To what extent are those tensions reflected in what's happening in Somalia also, and to what extent is there communication between the camps and people in Somalia? And I also found it was instructive to me earlier when we were talking how you described the fact that Somali land is a separate, sort of almost sounded like a little bit of an oasis in that area, and maybe just to share that and corroborate it, I don't know if anybody else has experience in yeah. that area. But that's a little bit on the types of tensions that are coming out in the camps and the way they relate to what's happening in Somalia itself, if at all.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'll try and answer that, and then if you want other questions, I'll add them in. The geography, Somaliland declared itself independent from the rest of Somalia at the outset of the civil war, and it's become a sort of haven of peace. They haven't been affected by the civil war that's racked the rest of the country since 1992. And they've managed to hold elections, they've got very good universities there, and it's definitely a source of tension with the South, because the South wants it to remain part of the federal Somalia. It's what used to be called British Somaliland, and southern area is what used to be called Italian Somaliland. And that goes also to the heart of the Kenyan prejudice, that in fact Greater Somalia was an area that stretched all the way to the mountains of Ethiopia and all the way to the to Mount Kenya and the plains of Kenya in the south. And that was historically the area across which Somali clans grazed and moved. But a third, basically two-thirds of that historic area has been taken away from Somalia. So a third of that Greater Somalia is Northeast Province, which is now part of Kenya. The other third is the Ogaden region of southern Ethiopia. And then the remaining third is actually what we have Somalia proper, which has then been subdivided into Somaliland and now Puntland and now lots of other little federal states all popping up, which unfortunately the CIA is supporting because it wants to ally warlord allies, just like in Afghanistan, where it sponsors particular local strongmen who then get paid bounties for kill and capture operations. So that current involvement is sort of fueling the breakup of the continued breakup of Somalia, even as al-Shabaab influence shrinks. So the clans, there are four major clans that to which people have some kind of affiliation, and their influence comes and goes. I mean, lots of people would argue that the clan it is actually a more recent construct whose importance has been overemphasized in recent years because of the civil war. And that it seems to be that because of the breakdown in all the other social structures during the war, that people then fell back on their clan. But in the camp, their clan is less important because there are democratic elections run by the UN, which are clean and which are basically one person, one vote, and your clan plays less of a role. There is a role in terms of nominating candidates and so on, but people are more or less free to vote how they wish. The clan doesn't have any real control over justice mechanisms because there are alternative ones in the camp. And also you have a lot of mixing because these people have been in this hot box for 20 years, all forced to get along, and they've all been going to school together through the UN system, that actually the new generation is very disdainful of the clan. So the Youth Umbrella, which is one of the organisations that I've spent lots of time with, conducts all of its business in English, because there are some refugees who are from Sudan, who are from Ethiopia, and it very viscerally eschews the language of clan completely and won't have it, and they have a lot of clashes with their elders who want them to marry in certain ways and so on. And there's quite a few songs and literature and poems now about how that's all wrong.
Yeah.
So there's definitely a big cultural change. And the roots of Kenyan prejudice is that the Northeast Province was voted to join Somalia proper at independence in 1959. Somalia became independent in 1960, but Kenya didn't become independent until 1963. And when Britain handed Kenya over to the Kenyans, back to the Kenyans, it didn't respect the wishes of Northeast Province to join Somalia. And what happened, the beginning of independence in Kenya was also the inauguration of something called the Shifter War, where Northeast Province was fighting to secede, to join Somalia. And that war continued into the 70s, and the state of emergency was only lifted in 1992, which was actually when the Somali Civil War started. So In a way, that area has been unstable ever since independence. And Kenya, the Kenyan government, views Somalis as a sort of fifth column, a very numerous and rich fifth column, who have a lot of influence in Nairobi as well. And so they're since then, the war, and since Kenya invaded Somalia to try and pacify it, there's been a lot of revenge bombings in Kenya, of which the most spectacular was the Westgate siege in Nairobi last year. So that has been the sort of catalyst to unleash all of this latent prejudice against Somalis, branding them all as al-Shabaab, basically.
Very good. we have some questions coming in from the crowds on some of the, if you want to think for a second, I can keep going. I'm curious also about the, I guess, the political status within the camps, this UN bubble, and how that happens. I suppose I just haven't been in UN bubbles all that much, but you were describing earlier that each, in that large camp, there's actually five separate camps, each has its own UN headquarters sort of place, and it's a relatively tight security situation because of you being potentially a kidnapped victim. How do the kids you're talking to view the sort of local authority structures, and how do they, it sounds almost too good to be true that they're all kind of super tolerant and yeah. singing songs. But is it, I mean, where, I don't know, what kind of political frameworks are they moving towards, do you think? Maybe they're too young to talk yet, or if there isn't the a big draw towards the Al-Shabaab type, you know, belonging to something, what is it that they are doing with their time, and how do they how do they avoid that pull? I would think that would be really difficult.
Well, the I mean, it's not all roses, for sure.
Yeah.
It's an ongoing humanitarian emergency. I mean, malnutrition is very high. Maternal mortality is really high. All of the human development indicators are terrible. Kenya doesn't allow the tents to be replaced. Doesn't allow people to build concrete homes, so everybody's sleeping on the sand, either in a tent or in a hut. So there's a lot of anger at Kenya. There's a lot of anger at the UN because people want better services. They want a better situation. But at the same time, you know, whenever a bomb goes off, it's to the Kenyan police or to the UN that they run.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a very sort of contradictory relationship that they rely on these people. They need them. They need the food, and yet they want more. They want more jobs, they want more shelter, and so on. And I think I think time is a problem, that once you've been through the school system and you're ejected into the world and you can't go anywhere and there are no jobs and you can't work, then you're, you know, I think you are at risk.
Yeah.
And you're looking for what to do. The shocking thing to me is why more people don't join Al-Shabaab or some other kind of militia.
Right.
And yet everybody I talk to is so hostile.
Uh-huh.
Is like, how dare you suggest that? I'm an educated person. You know,
good.
I've been to school. Even primary school kids will say that. I've been to school. That's not for me. You know.
That's amazing.
So what they're doing is living their days in this kind of limbo where they want to go back to Somalia, but is it safe and I've never been there and all I hear about it is war, and on the other hand, I'd really like to be Kenyan, and I'd like to go to Nairobi, and I'd like to work, but I can't. And the third option, which is supposed to be, well, there's sort of three durable solutions, which is resettlement, repatriation, integration, repatriation, or resettlement abroad. The third option is to be taken to a third country. Mm-hmm. So there are quotas every year for people to be taken to the US, to the UK, to Norway, to Sweden, and every year another one of those countries says no, we don't want any more. But before 9/11, the US was taking about 2,000 or 3,000 a year, and then it all changed, and now they're taking about 200 or 300, and the UK takes about 20 or 30, and Sweden takes about 10. So that is the third dream that everybody has, is to go away, and that's why they hate the UN, because everybody who was taken, there were large numbers of people leaving in the first 10 years of the camp to go elsewhere, and now that flow has slowed to a trickle. So people feel very let down. You know, I've been here since 92.
It's
my turn. It's not fair. You know, I should be taken somewhere else. And of course, they are, back to your point about communication, they're in touch with their friends who did go, who now have jobs and cars and You know, they're on Facebook, and they've mm-hmm. got Facebook on their phones, and they can see, you know, what's going
on. Are there remittances coming in?
Loads. Yeah. No, I mean, that's really one of the only sources of income, is the money coming back.
One final question for me, and then I will share the time, but I'm just curious, the other dimension that usually seems to have an impact on the various contexts where we work, are what are the natural resources, and who are the other international players in terms of being interested in what happens in Somalia or Somaliland for that matter? Mm. And are there other forces at play beyond, you mentioned, Saudis being sort of supportive of the madrasas, but superficially, of course, all we read about these days are the role of the Chinese in Africa and trying to work with the extractive industries and so forth. Is that a dimension on this at all, or can we leave that part aside?
It's getting there. It's becoming that way because Kenya discovered oil in Lodwa, which is the neighboring province, and for a long time, there's been lots of speculation about the sea between Kenya and Somalia, and there's an ongoing dispute about the border. Somaliland, they've started drilling with British companies, and there were exploration contracts that were all halted in 1991. So there is definitely some interest of oil companies getting back into Somalia. But I think from a geopolitical point of view, the main problem is that the big powers in the world, the EU and the US, don't care enough. It's not like Afghanistan, where the levels of resources and commitments and political investment is really high, or the rest of the Middle East. Somalia, you look at Mali, when there was a threat from Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb there, France stumped up $1.1 billion. Mm. In the London conference on Somalia raised $300 million, which is nothing really. Yeah. And most of that is going to keep this very corrupt government afloat. Mm-hmm. And that kind of suits everybody. Mm. It's actually an absence of commitment to peace in Somalia rather than a sort of any nefarious agenda, I don't think. And from the same point of view of Ethiopia and Kenya, both of whom now contribute forces to the AU peacekeeping force, both of whom have actually fought wars with Somalia over the territory that they've taken from Greater Somalia. They have no interest in a stable, peaceful Somalia, and yet they are presented in the international community as helpful. So I think that the geopolitical picture is that nobody really cares enough. It's up to the Somalis themselves. And yet the Somalis themselves are so riven after 20 years of war that everybody's traumatized. You can barely have a conversation without it deteriorating into a loss of victimhood. It's a very stubborn peace process.
Seems like a blatant conflict of interest to have Ethiopian countries involved in the...
You would have thought so. Yes.
Anyway, ideas or questions or observations I could...
Could you tell us a little bit more about Somaliland and how it's remained a haven during the situation? How did they avoid the civil war or maybe even refugees of their own?
They've had refugees. They've had refugee camps there. It's majority Isak clan, which is one particular clan, and they got themselves together very quickly as the rest of the country unraveled and realized what was happening, and basically drew a line over their historical area and set up their own provisional government. And they had, a bit like the English House of Lords, they established a kind of upper chamber where all the clan elders from the various sub-clans of the Isak got together and hammered things out. So there was a democratic chamber, but then there was also this kind of aristocratic chamber as well. And that dual process was able to kind of midwife a government, which has they kept their nose clean through the war. But it's a very interesting place for engagement because Hargeisa is a Somali city with good universities, as I mentioned in an earlier talk about and there's a teaching women's teaching hospital there that does a lot of good work. So there are good entry points in Somaliland for the rest of the region.
I just wanted to ask more about the educational structure within the Dadaab. So there's the UN school system. There are the madrasas. Is there a sense among students at the UN who go to the UN schools of dissatisfaction with the sort of bureaucratic structure and the curriculum, or is it generally regarded as a pretty good education? Is there a sense that the madrasas are more the schools of the people? Are there any alternatives to those two models? In other words, are there efforts to create grassroots schools that fill in gaps that the two existing structures don't manage to do?
Yeah. Well, the existing schools are, formally, they're under the authority of the Kenyan government, right. But the UN pays for everybody, pays for all the teachers. I think if there's dissatisfaction, it's because there are not enough teachers and there are not enough textbooks. So often you have the textbook is with the teacher, and then you have 50 students who don't have a textbook. So it's materials, it's the capacity of the teachers, it's sometimes the caliber of the teachers, because the Kenyan trained teachers there's only about 50% cover, 50% of the teaching population are trained Kenyan teachers. The other 50% are refugee volunteers who may or may not be trained. And the other thing that the students complain about, I think, is the opportunities afterwards. Is that if you don't get one of these 10 scholarships to a Canadian university run by the World University Service Canada, then you don't have an opportunity for further education at all, unless you have rich relatives somewhere in the West who can fund it. Because even a diploma is $500, $1,000, there's a distance learning diploma from Nairobi. So the opportunities that come afterwards are really limited. In addition to those kind of official Kenyan state schools, there are a couple of private schools which are run where diaspora people have contributed to build a school that fills a gap. And those are 100% staffed by Somali volunteers. They then have a struggle to get themselves registered for the Kenyan examination service, because they have to prove that their curriculum is to a certain standard and so on. People go to the madrasas anyway because they want to learn Quran. It's not seen as either or. But what it means is that if you can't afford to go, or you don't have a space to go to the secular education, that's all you end up with.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, we've got two right next to each other.
I was wondering if there are any plans for or provisions for technical training. So you mentioned earlier when we were talking with scholarships that it was based in the British system from the 50s. So after secondary school, you'd split off to secondary modern and to grammar school. And I think we've been talking more about those that would be more academically focused, who would go on to scholarships. But what about, is there any provision, or I know they may not have a job at the end,
yeah.
But is there any provision for that and then providing a service within the camps themselves?
Yeah. Do you want to ask your question as well and not answer that?
So I'd be interested, I think given the fact that there's this kind of resurgence of refugee situations around the world in other regions like Turkey and Syria, what are the sort of lessons from this case study of Dadaab, or is Dadaab so unique because of its long-lasting nature and the fact that children have kind of grown up for decades in there? Are there lessons for other, like the way education is handled in other refugee camps, in other geographic situations? And have they learned from Dadaab's mistakes, maybe, if other administrators?
On the vocational stuff, there are little short courses and things, and some of the agencies run these schemes called income-generating activities, where you learn a particular skill. It always seems to be kind of hippie skills like basket making and soap making and things that people want to buy, that aid workers might want to buy. But there are other things too, like butchery, stuff like that. And that's all in the black market. So although there's no formal jobs, there is a very big grey economy, and those so people can learn those skills and work in that way. But it's still only in the temporary city of the camp, you know. So adjusting your head to that idea as a with a horizon, you know, a business needs stability if you want to invest and grow and all of that kind of thing. So people are always transient in their plans. And that creates a very kind of unstable identity, not least an economy, but also an identity. In terms of the lessons learned, there is a whole sort of movement called Education in Refugee Camps, which is sponsored by the UN and which is around which there's a lot of research and academic stuff. I'm, you know, only kind of passingly familiar with it. But I don't think they've learned very much from Dadaab, and I think that what Dadaab is unique, because it's been there for such a long time, and because it's not going anywhere, it's, you know, the population kind of fluctuates between 300,000 and 400,000, and it's growing every month by 100,000, by 10,000, by 1,000, sorry, it's growing every year by 10,000, but the birth rate is 1,000 a month. So it's not going anywhere anytime soon, and that means that you can engage with these institutions like schools. You can plan around educating whole cadres of people. I think probably, especially with Syria, that agencies are going to have to learn from that and are going to have to get used to the fact that something like Zaatari. It's a city that's going to stay there, you know, and I think Kleinschmidt, the UN head of the Zaatari refugee camp, has done a great job in actually getting the Jordans ready for the idea that this is probably going to be here for a while, and structuring it and financing it in a way like a city, with the idea that it will grow with space to grow and so on. So I think he's definitely learned, because he's spent time in Dadaab and Mogadishu, and he came actually to Zaatari fresh from Mogadishu. So I think that's good. In terms of the educational system, I think that Zaatari is the only one I know a bit, rather than the others like Burma and places like that. But there, the school system is evolving very like Dadaab, where you have a national system and a national curriculum, and the UN is providing the means, and kids might go there for 3 years, for 5 years, but I reckon it's going to end up being 10, 20. And so the sooner you start treating these places as permanent, the better.
That gets
and preparing,
doesn't it?
And preparing the political, it's the political underpinnings of it, really, that are important. Because to Zaatari, at least they are dealing with it in a sort of 5 to 10 year time plan, whereas Dadaab, it's 6 months. This sort of fiction that in 6 months they might all be gone, it's not going to happen. And yet all of the plans are on this kind of very tight emergency humanitarian timetable.
I was reading something earlier today on the Al-Fanar media listserv about the Syrian refugee education situation and some of the tensions that happen, and I don't know, I think you were saying earlier that you didn't think this was really pertained to the Somalis, but nevertheless, the idea that there can be family pressures, particularly against young women in the family, to pursue education, and that can be, particularly if you are in a refugee situation. I think here the difference could be important, that in a Syrian context, you're more recently a refugee, and so the sort of trauma part of that might be more fresh.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that would be true with families that you've met, but another point that was, I think, being made by this woman who's done some very interesting research, I'll have to give you this name when we get back upstairs, was that it's important to have education efforts in these contexts incorporate at some level the family, and to not make it just for something for individual students to partake in or something like that, but to engage parents and extended family so that, more people feel invested in the whole process of having, you know, one of the children or something get further along in the education. When you've done your interviews and your exchanges and conversations with the kids for your book, what's your sense of their family, and does that play out? I mean, do you think that, you know, is, because there can be, you were talking earlier, there's also this generational tension between those under 20 and those over 40. Is that playing out also in the families? Is there kind of the resentment, perhaps, of one towards the other that would inhibit the kids going further?
I mean, there are as many stories as there are people, and I think you're right in the sense that everybody's family situation has a major impact on the choices they make, and that definitely comes across in the individual stories of the people I've been following. So, for example, one kid could have afforded to go to school, but chose to spend the money on supplementing his family's diet instead. So he had a small job shining shoes, but, you know, some of his mates were using that money to go to school, but he was using that to support his family. Another boy who was very good at school and won and became top of his class and got to secondary school, which was like, you know, that's like winning an OSI fellowship. You know, you're really happy about that. To get into the secondary school, it was a big party. And yet he was thinking of dropping out because his father had left his mother, had gone back to Mogadishu, and she needed money for formula for her child. And he was going to quit that and get a job in the informal market, earning money to do that. So there's those sorts of family obligations. I didn't ever encounter a family who said they didn't want their girl to go to school because she was a girl. I've met people say we didn't want. I met a mother who said she didn't want her girl to go to school because she needed to work, because the family needed everybody to gather as many coins as they could in order to supplement the income. Because the UN rations is only 2,000 calories a day, which is very finely calibrated, and that's a certain amount of rice and beans and oil. And that's it. So, and if you want tea or sugar or greens or meat, then you've got to do something else, you know, which is all these other, hard jobs at the bottom of the food chain. But then there's a case of another guy who got all the way through school, finished secondary school, got a diploma, was offered a job for the Danish Refugee Council in Mogadishu. And his father was so traumatized by the loss of his other children during the war, he said, "You're never going back to Somalia." So that would have been $2,000 a month to look after everybody. But no, you know, because he didn't want to lose another kid.
Yeah.
So everybody's got these different stories. And everybody's got an excuse why they dropped out of school. It was because of this. And oh, it was because of that. So...
Anybody else on the whole? Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
I guess I have like several kind of questions. One, when you were talking about refugees being resettled into a third country and how the numbers have significantly decreased, what are some of the determining factors now that are being used to determine who gets the opportunity to resettle? Is one. The other one is, you mentioned earlier the kind of very little opportunities for refugees in these camps, and how some of them mainly just aspire to work for the UN or work for some large NGO as kind of their main goal. And I wonder, how do you it almost creates a sort of dependency, if it's almost like instead of being given a ration, you are kind of working, but it's not really determined how long these organizations will be there for the most part. I mean, it is the goal for them to kind of stop. There's an end date. And I just wonder, what are the sort of initiatives that are being used, or if there are, in terms of maybe moving them from the exclusionary and only operating within the camp and more inclusionary, whether inside of like, working within the larger society is like the second. And the third, which kind of now escapes me. To the first one.
Well, if you, yeah, you remember.
Yeah.
The resettlement is, yeah, it used to be a lot more generous. I don't really know why it's shrinking, other than prejudice, really. I mean, I don't think there's any, especially in Europe, the nationalist agenda in Europe is really causing this asylum space to shrink. The criteria for who gets chosen are supposed to be on the basis of protection, disability, or discrimination. So, or sorry, protection includes both of those things, discrimination and disabilities, or medical reasons. So if you're from a minority and you're getting some sort of persecution in the camp, then that you should be fast-tracked then for resettlement. If you have a medical emergency, that's the same reason. And sometimes some countries have particular focuses on unaccompanied minors. Some countries have particular focuses on rape victims, and they work with the UN and submit certain quotas, and then the UN will fill those quotas and send those people off. There was a big scandal in 2001 where there was basically a ring of people working for the UNHCR who were selling these spots. And that still is sort of the perception among the refugees that it's for sale. And I think to some extent they're probably right, but it's very hard to get to the bottom of all of that. working for the agencies and whether that's... I mean, any kind of work is great. So in that situation, and yes, you don't know where you're going to be in a year or two, but at least I've got a job now, and I'm being able to support my family and to, you know, a job means that we don't just eat rice and beans. That's really what it's about. And we can afford clothes, you know, and you can buy a radio, and you know, your life can get a little bit better. So they're not, nobody's really thinking beyond 12 months. You know, there might be dreams and ideas beyond that time, but for practical planning purposes, nobody's really thinking beyond 12 months. So that's the kind of psychological reality of living in this bounded place. And I mean, I perhaps neglected to mention, one of the things is if you do get to work for the agencies could then employ you back in Somalia, they can move you back, you could then shift from a volunteer contract where you're paid a stipend in the camp to a proper salaried post. So the competition to be a volunteer for the agencies and you know, because the agencies can't pay them as well as they pay Kenyans, because the Kenyan government doesn't want the refugees to work and take the jobs of Kenyans. It's exactly the same as most countries, you know, have this sort of distinction. So people work for the agencies as volunteers and they get paid a stipend. So that the reason there's competition for that is not only because they want the money, but also because once they get friendly with the agencies, there's a possibility that they might be able to work somewhere else for the agency. And in theory, there does exist the right for those agencies to hire people and get work permits and then put them elsewhere in Kenya. And then you might be able to begin a process of applying for citizenship and stuff like that. So there are many reasons why the agencies are helpful, not just because they're the overlords, but also because of that.
Question, you made reference earlier to people having Facebook on their phones, but they have to work to get extra money to get more than rice and beans. Mm. How are they getting the phones?
Well, because they're saving up that money.
For that purpose.
Yeah, they're begging those things from their uncles, from their cousins, from me, from people from abroad. So, you know,
it's interesting.
And lots of people have, you know, they're not.
But the connectivity is good.
Yeah, there's a mobile signal.
Yeah.
It's not 3G, but it's good enough.
Mm-hmm. Right, interesting.
Yeah.
High connectivity, low meat.
Right. Yeah. And a lot of people have just the regular, like, Nokia phones that don't have smart functions, but then but for the educated youth who've been to school, they probably do have one of these incentive jobs, intern jobs with the agency, so they are earning $90 a month,
okay,
you know, which is enough to get yourself a phone.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And just quickly, I'm curious as well, when you talk about, I guess I want to think more about that interaction with Mogadishu and the camps and so forth, and you mentioned the Danish Refugee Council being in Mogadishu. Who else? Just is it the usual, you know, menu of Save the Children, Oxfam, whatnot, or and how many universities are there, and that sort of, you know, what is the state of Mogadishu in terms of I don't know, broadly in our shorthand, I guess, civil society.
Yeah. It's very active. I mean, there's a lot going on. There's a lot going on there. There's three universities I know of. I think there's more than that, though. There's a national university, there's a Turkish university, and there's this one called Atlas. Okay. But I think there's a technical university as well, and possibly something else. So, some of them have been going through the war on real skeleton staff, but they've kept it going. The money that's come in over the last kind of 18 to 24 months has been really quite astonishing, and that's mostly diaspora cash. So people investing back home, trying to get the city running again. And if you look at photos of how it was 2 years ago and how it is now, the change is really amazing in terms of construction, in terms of the streets, in terms of traffic. So it's definitely a functioning city. There's a lot of civil society groups there. Some of them are under threat, but there's the whole range that you'd expect. It's not Nairobi, but you know, they're there and they're working and they're trying. But generally, the good ones get oversubscribed, but I think that's probably true everywhere.
Go ahead.
I'm curious if there's any pressure being put on the Kenyan government, either by civil society organizations or perhaps even external actors, to to integrate some of the refugees in, or at least at the very least provide some basic services, sanitation, education. Is there any pressure coming from anywhere within Kenya?
No, not. There's something called the Refugee Consortium of Kenya. That's the only refugee rights organization that's run by Kenyans.
Wow.
All of the NGOs that OSEA funds are mainly, their focus is not refugees or Somalis, it's usually Muslim issues. So that's the lens through which they see it. So the famous one is Muhuri, the Muslims for Human Rights in Kenya, who OSEA has been very strong funders of, and they do great work, but they don't have a focus on refugees. They've all been working on refugee issues lately because of this Usalama Watch roundup of anybody that looks Somali. But they've been coming at it mostly from a Muslim perspective, that this is an attack on Muslims, that this is an infringement of our rights, and we Muslims need to come together. But the Somali sort of community is not very well integrated into the Muslim community in Kenya. The Muslims are mostly Swahilis from the coast and various other groups, but the central government treats them as all the same, but actually there's nobody in Nairobi standing up for refugee rights, and that's a big problem.
And there's no other, did you remember? I was just curious very quickly because you made me think about what is the role of other African regional entities. IGAD doesn't engage on it or wouldn't have an interest.
They're all governmental agencies. Okay. So IGAD was the place where the Kenyan president announced that he wanted refugees to go back to Somalia, expecting the Somali government to help.
I see.
And the Somali government said, yes, we'll help, because they obviously they want all those able-bodied people working in back home. But that there was no refugees were consulted on that.
Yeah.
They weren't present. Nothing to do with them at all.
Politics.
Yeah, it's just politics. And the AU is really about... Somalia doesn't like the AU because Ethiopia and Kenya use the AU to undermine it.
For the other question, you have mentioned some successful kind of organizations like the Aga Khan schools, and I was wondering how were they able to keep students in and make it through kind of primary and secondary education and kind of combat some of the reasons why students are unable to go to school, mostly related to like economic situations. How did they combat that?
The Aga Khan?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I think that the Aga Khan is the Aga Khan schools I'm talking about are in cities,
yeah.
In Nairobi, in Dar es Salaam, in Mombasa. They're very well funded, and there's a large portion of they're also to some extent serving their own community, the Ishmaelis, who are generally very well off.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if you get to go to the Aga Khan school, then probably you don't have to worry about uniform and books and stuff.
So but they're not trying to make inroads into the camps per se.
They're just sort of a model of good education.
I was
simply referring to them as a private foundation that funds formal education, and how I think it's good.
Mm-hmm.
That's all.
Anne, you want to speak on behalf of HEST and talk about the potential of building a university in Revolution?
For the next board meeting.
I'm sole representative of the Higher Education Support Program.
Oh, okay.
Did you meet Voldemort when you were in London?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
He didn't offer you a couple million dollars?
No.
HEST does that sort of thing.
Okay. Right. So they're the ones I need to go.
Exactly. Exactly. Or Lenny, if you've met Lenny. Yeah,
no.
Hit him up for some cash.
Right.
It's good for that. I don't think we have responded to the challenges that you've put forward to OSI. And I, although I will say on behalf of scholarships, it is very much a question larger, not just for the Somali situation, but what you've said about the situation in Somalia has really sort of changed my thinking. About the potentials and our own, you know, where we can make a little bit of difference, perhaps. But it really does help if there is the potential for traction in the so-called home country. And I think that that is something that I'd be like to have more conversations about and to take further in terms of what we could do. Earlier, as the scholarships people here were aware of, Ben had suggested, you know, the idea of working with the universities in Mogadishu to offer scholarships there to Somalis and so that they could return back. And that's a model that we haven't really done before in scholarships. But as I said, it really is dependent on us having different communication with the OSEA staff and sort of figuring out whether that's feasible. But I'd certainly be interested in learning a little bit more about that, because that sounds more like a window opening than closing. So and that's what usually makes the difference. And I'd be curious to know if the OSEA office, I know Benifer was very excited about having you come and talk with us about this. But so I wonder if the changing situation or the changing sort of environment in Mogadishu and Somalia generally is having an impact on how OSEA's strategy and grant giving on related issues. Is
the only thing I know about that is bad news, and that was that the programs that they were funding in northern Kenya were cut when I spoke to them.
Mm.
I spent time in their office in March,
and
that was just at the time when that had happened.
When it happened, yeah.
Yeah, which I was very sad about, and what I'm talking about is in any case doing things slightly differently.
Yeah.
But northern Kenya and the intersection of human rights, Muslim issues, Somali issues,
right,
and countering the general conservative tide that's flowing down from Saudi, is something that I think needs to be more creatively, or should perhaps frame more the way that things are done in that
right.
region.
Right, right. Stay sensitized
that's
to
the
it.
Way
no,
it
sounds
be.
Logical. Anything more from you, Steve?
No, thank you, Ben.
Thank you all for
thank
joining.
You. Thanks for coming.